Israelis are now celebrating 75 years of independence, 75 years of self-determination for the Jewish people in part of their ancient homeland, which for centuries was ruled by foreign empires. There are not many nations that, as the late Charles Krauthammer used to point out, are living in the same land, worshiping the same God, and speaking the same language as did their ancestors 3,000 years ago. But not everyone is celebrating. Islamic Jihad, a terrorist organization funded, armed, and instructed by the Islamic Republic of Iran, recently fired hundreds of missiles at Israel from Gaza, a territory which Israel withdrew from in 2005. Israelis retaliated with precision strikes targeting Islamic Jihad leaders. For the moment, a ceasefire is in effect. On May 15th, Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas delivered a Nakba Day speech at the UN General Assembly. Now, Nakba is Arabic for catastrophe, which is how he and other enemies of Israel regard Israel's birth. Abbas said that the U.S. and Britain are to be blamed for creating Israel in order to get rid of their Jews. And he claimed that despite Israel's efforts to excavate under the Al-Aqsa Mosque, which is also the site of what Jews call the Temple Mount, no historical or archaeological evidence has been found proving that Jews were present in Jerusalem in the past. In Washington, Representative Rashida Tlaib staged her own Nakba event with help from Bernie Sanders. And Foreign Affairs, a prestigious American journal, published a long article that also made no attempt to suggest how peaceful coexistence between Israelis and Palestinians might be achieved. The four authors suggested instead that the root of the conflict is, as Islamic Jihad, Mr. Abbas, and Ms. Tlaib would have it, Israel's existence. The solution, implied rather than stated, is to rip out the root. The consequences of such a policy, not least for the more than 9 million Israelis, were not explored. Elliot Abrams read the article and responded in Pressure Points, his blog, which is always worth reading. Elliot has served at high levels in several administrations. He is currently a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, which happens to be the publisher of Foreign Affairs. He's been good enough to drop in to speak with us today. We're glad you're with us, too, here on Foreign Odyssey. Elliot, thanks for coming in. It's really good. It's always good to see you.
Good to be back.
The title of your post, As Israel Turns 75, Foreign Affairs Publishes a Call to Eliminate It. Did you have to think about that for a while, whether you should write that kind of rebuttal and state it that clearly?
I did. It's a little difficult because Foreign Affairs is, as you said, published by Council on Foreign Relations, CFR. But I thought, they started, right? I mean, they're the ones who published this. And I was also struck that many publications, when they have an article like this, will then publish a second piece taking a different view or announce we're going to have one or two or three or four more. They didn't do that then. I think with the number of protests, they now say that in future issues, they'll have several people responding. But that, I think, was clearly not the original plan. So they published this article. I thought, in a way, it's particularly good to have a response at the council's own website.
You know, it just strikes me extraordinary. I mean, Pakistan is about the same age as Israel, maybe a year older, if memory serves. It also came out of the same – we had end of World War II, empires – begin to disintegrate or collapse. The nations want to be free. If they survive, you look at them on a significant birthday. Can you imagine Foreign Affairs or Foreign Policy or The Atlantic saying, oh, let's do a piece saying what a failure Pakistan is, how there should never have been a nation carved out of India with a Muslim majority. And really, it's got to go at some point. Let's celebrate their birthday that way. I imagine that would be that editorial meeting never happened.
That's right. You might have an article. You certainly have had articles that say these are the problems with this country and here are the ways to fix it. But what this article really said, I thought, was, you know, there's one Jewish state in the world, and that's one too many.
Right.
That's why I use the word elimination, because their one state argument suggests the combination of the West Bank, Gaza, and Israel in one state. And that state, you know, if it has an Arab majority and eliminates what we know as modern Israel, tough. I mean, that's really their argument.
Right. And there's two things that they might have wanted to consider before making that argument or when they're making that argument in the piece. One is that, for example, there are 22 members of the Arab League. These are all Arab states. There may be minorities in those states, but they're assertively Arab states. Is it wrong to have a state that is assertively an Arab state? If not, why can't you have a Jewish state? There's many more states that are members of the Organization of Islamic Cooperation. Maybe that's not what it's called anymore. I can't remember. But they're Islamic states, essentially. They see Islamic law as being principal. Again, they have minorities. In none of those countries, I would say, do minorities have equal rights? I don't think there are any. But they're not taking that on, no. But there's one state with a Jewish majority, one state that says we're trying to look at Jewish law, Jewish history. There are minorities. 20% of the population of the Israelis are Israeli citizens are Arab and Muslim, give or take. I would argue, I don't think it's really an argument, that if you are a minority in Israel, an Arab minority, a Muslim minority, you have more rights than any minority in any other country in the Middle East or any majority in the Middle East. You have more rights as an Israeli Arab than you have as a Syrian Arab or even a Jordanian Arab.
Yep.
This, I just said, these facts, and I think they're facts, don't seem to occur to the four authors. Now, let me just say, we should just say who the authors are. Mm-hmm. Michael Barnett is University Professor of International Affairs and Political Science at the Elliott School of International Affairs at George Washington University. Nathan Brown, Professor of Political Science, International Affairs at George Washington University, and a non-resident senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Mark Lynch is Professor of Political Science and International Affairs at George Washington University. And Shibli Telhami is Anwar Sadat Professor of Peace and Development at the University of Maryland and a non-resident senior fellow at the Brookings Institute. Okay, so just so we know who we're talking about. And bounce off anything I'm saying, but I'll make one more point, and at least one more point. And that one more point is this. If it's true that they say that there's a one-state reality, it's interesting that they think that all the blame for that must be on Israel. After all, the Israelis do recognize, all right, there's a Palestinian people that don't know that it existed in the 7th century or the 9th century or the 18th century. Because after all, who are the leaders of the Palestinian people? Mahmoud Abbas, Yasser Arafat, and before that, there was
Haji Amin al-Husseini.
Right, who did not consider himself a Palestinian, who was actually the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, who was appointed by the British. The British governor happened to be Jewish at the time, and Haj Amin al-Husseini spent World War II in Berlin, a kind of comfortable place to be and convenient if you're working with Adolf Hitler for the cause of Nazism, which he is. Nevertheless, the Israelis have explored a two-state solution, but we've just heard from Mahmoud Abbas at the UN that he denies that Jews were ever in Judea, that Jews were ever in the Judean hills, that Jews were ever in the Jewish quarter of the old city of Jerusalem. He won't even acknowledge there is such a thing as a Jewish people. And yet the onus for there not being a two-state solution, that there's only going to be a one-state solution, that's not on him. That's not on Palestinians. It's absolutely on the Israelis.
The article doesn't review the modern history. For example, you know, Ehud Barak's proposal at Camp David or Ehud Olmert's proposal or the Bill Clinton parameters or President Obama's offer. It doesn't do any of that.
And we just say, without going into it, we're talking about up to 97% of the West Bank shared a sovereignty of Jerusalem. So refugees could return, at least some of them, not their descendants necessarily. All those things, when those were put on the table, they were those offers. And of course, the 1948 UN partition offer, which said, hey, one state for the Arabs of Palestine, well, one state for the Jews. They refused, and it was never a forthcoming, how about this instead? We never saw that.
There's never been any kind of a yes. And you can go back, in fact, let's go back before 48 to the late 30s, the so-called Peel Commission that the British had, which came up with the idea of partition, which supported partition. And the Mufti and others rejected that. So the rejection basically is we don't want to compromise because that means there'll be a Jewish state. And there has been a refusal all along by the Palestinian leadership. Now, one of the interesting things about this article as well is they took it upon themselves to speak for a group of people they call the Palestinians. Now, normally we divide people who live in the West Bank Palestinians, from Israeli Arabs who are citizens of Israel. They don't do that. They don't refer to Israeli Arabs, citizens of Israel, who are now roughly 21% of all Israelis. On the one hand, on the other hand, West Bank. No. They just refer to Palestinians. What's interesting about that is they're speaking on behalf of all of these people, but in fact, they are not representing their views. The Israel Democracy Institute, which is a left-of-center organization, with which I am connected, by the way, has done, they do polls every year. They did a poll a couple of years ago that found that 7% of Israeli Arabs wanted to be referred to as Palestinians. To be an Israeli Arab is to be in a permanent minority, something that Jews have a lot of familiarity with. It's not the greatest.
Jews have been minorities in a lot of countries. Yeah, has its good points, has its bad points.
But your point is right. That is, Israeli Arabs have all of the human rights and civil rights that Israeli Jews do. They vote. And their votes, as we've seen in some recent elections, can matter. And of course, what's the comparison? In the West Bank, there hasn't been an election since 2006, long time. Abbas has been president since 2005, 18 years without being reelected.
18 years into a four-year term, as they say.
But yeah, but what's so striking about these professors is their insistence that, you know, they know what all Israeli Arabs want, and they want a one-state solution. There's no evidence for that. And in fact, such evidence as there is in polls suggests a very significant proportion, usually majority, of Israeli Arabs saying that they identify with the state of Israel and see a common destiny with non-Muslim, non-Arab Israelis. 100%? Of course not. But in some of the IDI polls, certainly most of the IDI polls, a majority or a plurality. So who do these professors represent? I think what they represent is a very old view that there just should not be a Jewish state. It's a mistake. It's wrong. And it's got to come to an end.
Well, I don't want to jump ahead, but I want to just put this on the table. When you say it must come to an end, the question is, what does that mean? I mean, it's one thing to be an anti-Zionist before there's a Jewish state and say, I don't think this is a good idea. It's another thing to say that it must come to an end now. Are all the Jewish Israelis to get in little boats and, you know, try to make it to, I don't know, to Berkeley or Brooklyn or something like that? I think that's unlikely. Or are you saying, well, it may be a genocide, but that's their fault, not mine, so I'm not going to worry about it. Or are you going to say, look, they'll have to live as a minority, as Jews have lived as a minority in other Arab countries. And in fact, that's true. They lived for many centuries as minorities in other Arab countries, sometimes worse, sometimes better. But they were expelled from almost all of those countries, about 850,000 of them, after World War II. Many came to Israel, strengthening the state. It was an odd thing. If you were against Zionism, and then you might want to say, look, there's no need for it because look how good our Jewish minority here in Algeria or Libya or Iraq live. But no, that's not the case. Jordan's one of the more moderate states, but doesn't allow Jews to be citizens. So for all those reasons, you write an article like this and you don't say at any point, if we think the problem is the existence of Israel, here's what we think would happen if Israel would only accept our argument and say, okay, we give it up. We give up the concept of self-determination. And then what happens? Not to say that. I don't know. I think it's irresponsible.
Well, I agree with that. What's missing is the word security. First, under the current circumstances, how could you have a two-state solution if it seems obvious, and it does to me, that Hamas, Hezbollah, Iran would be the most influential forces in the West Bank. But okay, let's go beyond that. Now we want a one-state solution, right? What is the security situation in that state? What prevents intercommunal warfare, for example? What prevents Hamas, worse yet, Islamic Jihad, other groups tied to Iran and Hezbollah, from engaging in terrorism, from engaging in massive disorder? That's a very interesting question, which is not asked. It is not dealt with in this article. The assumption, there is a kind of assumed answer to your question, which is it'll all be fine. Now, why would that be? I mean, given, for one thing, the history of democracy, sadly, in the Arab world, including to this day, we used to say that there was one Arab democracy, which was Tunisia, and it was for about 10 years after the Arab Spring, which began in Tunisia, and it's gone. It just parenthetically, it's the one country that was a democracy the day Joe Biden became president and isn't today. Other than that, you know, he could have gone out campaigning and saying, on my watch, not one. No, but it's not true, because Tunisia fell into tyranny. So now there are zero Arab countries that are true democracies. So why would you think that Israel would end up, or whatever, I mean, the word Israel's probably got to go too, right? So right. Whatever
Palestine.
We call it, Palestine, why would we think it would be peaceful, and why would we think it would be a democracy? And then, of course, that leads to the next question, which is, so tell me why this is a lot better for Arab Israelis, and tell me why this is a lot better, let's say, for West Bank Palestinians. Now, their situation is, you know, is not admirable, let's say, because they live under a tyranny. But even there, you know, if you look at the—
And when you talk about the tyranny on the West Bank, you're talking about the Palestinian Authority or the Israelis?
No, I'm talking about the Palestinian Authority, right. No elections, and an increasingly despotic rule by Abbas.
Or no rule by Abbas in parts of the West Bank. The Northern West Bank, it's not clear he rules, whether he can't or doesn't want to. I'm not close enough to, and I hear disputes about that. Because in the Northern West Bank, increasingly, you've got Hamas and Islamic Jihad. You've got the Iranians coming in and calling the shots. You've got new terrorist groups like the Lions Den. So we don't know. One of the things, if you have this new Palestine, because they say, oh, these professors know what they're talking about. They've studied this for a long time. Okay, let's do what they say. Okay, so Hamas becomes in Gaza, from which the Israelis withdrew in 2005, by the way, based in large part on the premise that if the problem here is our occupation, if we stop occupying one of the Palestinian territories, we'll facilitate peace. That didn't happen. So Hamas becomes what, a political party at this point? And people in Gaza get to vote. But we know people in what Hamas wants is not to be a political party. It hasn't said, oh, if you just make us a political party and let us vote in Israeli elections, all will be well. They said, no, what we want to do is we want to kill or exile the Jews. This is in their charter. So that's not a problem that should be dealt with by these professors. Then you have the Palestinian authorities saying the West Bank, set up by the Oslo peace process, so to speak. What would happen to the Palestinian Authority? Would it go away? Would they no longer – or do you say – no, Palestinians in the West Bank get to vote for the Palestinian Authority when the Palestinian Authority wants to have elections, if they should want to do that again, we don't know. And then they get to vote in the Israeli elections too. How about Israelis living in parts of the West Bank? Did they get to vote for the Palestinian Authority too?
You know, you mentioned the word Gaza, and I want to read one sentence from the article. Even after it withdrew forces from Gaza in 2005, the Israeli government retained control over the territory's entry and exit points, close quote. Now, it's a really interesting sentence. Why? Because there is a border between Gaza and Egypt, because there is a crossing point, Rafah, because Palestinians can enter and Gaza Palestinians can enter and exit Gaza, through Sinai, can go, for example, to Cairo, if Egypt permits it. It's completely out of the control of Israel and under the control of Egypt. So that sentence that I read, I mean, how can you How can you write that sentence? You're a big shot professor. You're a great specialist and expert. You know
Actually, you probably have access to a map.
It's completely misleading, and I would say probably deliberately misleading a sentence. Now, you know, going back to what you're saying, presumably there'd be a new government in Jerusalem, which would be the capital of this new country. But I mean, what they're, you know, think what they're not saying. I think it would be very reasonable to write an article that says, well, you know, we had all these efforts at the two-state solution. Partition, again, it's a concept from the 30s, 40s. We have lots of peace negotiations, and nothing has really happened in about 20 years. And the PA seems to be increasingly corrupt and brutal, and as you said, losing control. So what is to be done? This is a very good question. This is a very difficult question. Is the PA dying? What happens after Abbas, who's 87, mm-hmm. Lee's officer dies? Does the PA collapse, and what replaces it? What are the options here? That's a very good question. They didn't ask that question, really. They said the answer is already in place because Israel controls everything. It controls all of Gaza. It controls the entire West Bank. As a colonizer, as a kind of imperial power. So the only question left, and we're going to hear more and more and more of this argument, the only question left is the human rights question. And Palestinians are suffering, and so the United States government, and they say this, the United States government and other democratic governments should be attacking Israel for its violations of human rights, should be sanctioning Israel and its leaders for their violations of Palestinian human rights, because basically it is all one state, except only Jews really have rights and everybody else lives on sufferance, which is also false. So it's what's really so striking to me here again is you could have raised serious questions and you could have looked at serious arguments. This is not that. This is just an assault on Israel by four big-shot professors. These are well-known names that blames Israel, as you said, for everything, claims to speak on behalf of all Israeli Arabs, and, you know, it has a solution, which is one Jewish state is one too many.
Right. And, you know, if I were a Palestinian, I might find this a little offensive in that the suggestion here is that the Palestinians have no agency whatsoever. Yep. They've had no influence over the peace process, yep, over what's happened to them, over what happened in Gaza when the Israelis left, over what happened after Oslo and the Palestinian Authority was set up in the West. They have no say. They're just not, are they not smart enough? They're not strong enough. They're not decisive enough. They're kind of left out of this whole thing. They're just over on the side, right? And then they also, it's interesting, they use these buzzwords, these kind of woke leftist buzzwords like supremacy, only here it's not white supremacy, it's Jewish supremacy, okay, yep, and settler colonialism and apartheid. And as you point out, they don't quite say Israel has a system of apartheid. You really can't say that with a straight face about Israeli Arabs, because if you go into a hospital, your doctor is as likely almost to be an Israeli Arab as he is to be a Jewish doctor. The pharmacist is likely to be. In the universities, what, 18% of university students are Arab now.
In a country that's 21% Arab.
You cannot say that. But you can say, oh, yeah, but go to Ramallah. However, and I got to make this point too. I've been to Ramallah many times, as you probably have, yep, and all that. Not the best place. It's not like going to Geneva. Not the worst place in the world. Good hotels, restaurants, get a beer. You know, it's like going to Amman or something like that. Let me tell you, it's not like going to Aleppo. It's not like going to – we've had about 500,000 Arabs murdered over the past 12 years in Syria. We've had about 5 million displaced, either refugees in Syria. Would you rather live in Damascus, Aleppo, or would you rather live in Ramallah? I think – by any objective measure, Ramallah. And by the way, what's the upshot of all this? I wrote about this just the other day. Bashar al-Assad is being welcomed back into the Arab League, and he will be at the next summit meeting that will be taking place. And I guess they're going to give him a slap on the back and a hug and a handshake. And this is still going on. And he's, by the way, he's also selling Captagon throughout the Middle East to make a little extra money for himself and his criminal family.
You used a word that we should talk about for a minute, apartheid.
Yeah, sure.
As you said, they don't come out and they don't say, as I noted in my blog post, they don't say Israel's an apartheid state. They don't say that. They talk around it, and then they have this amazing line. I think you have to be a fancy professor for this. Quote, Israel's system may not technically be apartheid, but it rhymes, period, close quote.
How poetic.
Well, yeah, it's very poetic. Now, you're quite right. I mean, I, as somebody actually visited South Africa in the bad old days of apartheid, anytime you go out in the street in Israel, you know, you will see a group of soldiers, some of whom are black because they are from Ethiopia. You will see a group of school kids who are black and white and all different colors because Israelis come from all different parts of the world. The figures you used, which I use in the article, you know, about college students, now referring to Arabs, about nurses, pharmacists, to call that society an apartheid society is really quite remarkable. I mean, it's false. So how is it that people say it? Well, we know why they say it. They say it because it's highly emotive, because right. It appeals not to the mind, but to the emotions. And it is one of the worst things you can say about any society. And they're using that term against Israel. You know how many waves of Ethiopian Jews have been brought to Israel? And they use the word apartheid. And by the way, among the most racist societies in the world are many of the Arab states on the basis of what? Skin color.
Sudan would be among them, by the way, which is at war as of right now. Right, the Darfurians. There was a genocide of the Darfurians. What are they? They're not Arabized Africans. They're Bantu Africans, essentially, right?
These are all the things we're mentioning, including the use of the word apartheid. Seems to me to speak to the question of what is the motivation here, and what is the objective here. It's not to raise questions, it seems to me. It's not to say, let's start an important debate. It's to demonize. It's to vilify. And to, you know.
Demonize and delegitimize so you can destroy. I mean, is that going too far? I don't think it is.
No. There's a terrible phrase that the late Senator Daniel P. Moynihan used to use.
I knew him.
Called joining the jackals. And he referred to it when he was UN ambassador, that you had all of these states around the world who knew better, but were joining the jackals. This was the Zionism is racism resolution when he was UN ambassador. These four guys are joining the jackals. They are making common cause with people who want to eliminate the Jewish state.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Right. If it's apartheid, it's racist. It doesn't deserve to exist. Therefore,
right. It's the worst human rights crime.
Another thing they write, that the way to treat Israel is the way the Biden administration has been defending international laws and norms in response to Russia's invasion of Ukraine. How I find that very odd. If you think about it, there are three states that are endangered very, very clearly and imminently in the world right now. One is Ukraine, because if Russia wins, the people of Ukraine will be subjugated. They will be told, you are Russian. They will be brought up, you have to speak Russian, think right. You can no longer think of yourself as a separate nationality. That's over. And the Ukrainians quite understand that. I did a podcast recently with the Ukrainian ambassador. This is our war of independence. Either we make it or we don't. Okay. Then you have Taiwan. It's also being threatened. They're being told by Beijing, you must be ruled not by China, but by the Chinese Communist Party. You're not Taiwanese. You're Chinese. Accept it. We told the people of Hong Kong the same thing. We had promised them that we wouldn't do that for a while, but we had a treaty, but never mind. We did. This is you will be subjugated too. And then there is Israel. And the only difference here is that Israel's enemies don't want to subjugate them. They want to eliminate them. They want to exterminate them. They've been very clear about that. And they fought in the war in 1948 by all Israel's Arab neighbors was to kill the baby in the cradle before Israel could begin. And then you have 1967. Again, all the Arab neighbors said, they're very clear on this. So there are quotes you can find. I've written them in articles. We are going to destroy like the Mongols. We're going to destroy and kill the Jews. 1973, same thing. And they're still saying that to this very day. So that's what's going to say, no, no, it's the Palestinians who are like Ukraine and it's Israel that's like Russia. Israel's not trying to tell people in Gaza, they wouldn't have withdrawn in 2005, you cannot think of yourself as Palestinians. You cannot be independent. You cannot have self-determination. They're saying you can. But you have to find a way to live peacefully with us, or we're going to make life a little more difficult for you. We're going to make it harder for you to bring in weapons to use to kill us. Can you bring in medicine? Can you bring in food every day? Can workers from Gaza come and work in Israel? We welcome them. Absolutely. All that you can have. We just don't want you killing us. Is that too much to ask? And the answer, of course, has been, yeah, it's too much to ask. So how they can make this parallel with between Palestinians and Ukraine when it is exactly the opposite, and their professors and their distinguished professors, it strikes me as absolutely a remarkable.
Again, I come back to this question of for whom do they speak? It's clear to me, and I think there's plenty of opinion poll data, that they don't speak for Israeli Arabs. Do they speak for West Bank Palestinians? You know, there are some opinion polls, for example, suggesting that West Bank Palestinians actually hate their leadership and are a little bit more pro-Hamas because they don't live under Hamas. Gaza Palestinians hate their leadership much more than the Palestinian Authority because they don't live under it. But this whole question, it seems to me, is in part a reminder of the importance of leadership. At the beginning of this conversation, you mentioned Haji Amin al-Husseini, the mufti appointed by the British in a tragic, tragic, tragic mistake because he led the Palestinians into violence against the Jews. You know, the next big leader after him was really Arafat, who was a terrorist and led Palestinians back in the same direction. As I look back really to my own career, this question of leadership is so important. I mean, you think of Southern Africa, for example, Nelson Mandela and Robert Mugabe. Mandela in South Africa, Mugabe in Zimbabwe emerge as rulers essentially the same time, the 80s. And look at the two countries. I mean, Mugabe destroyed Zimbabwe while Mandela was trying to turn South Africa into a peaceful, law-abiding country. There are a lot of examples of this, but Arafat is probably the most recent one. Many, many Israelis said to him, and many Arabs said to him, you are making a phenomenal historic error. Your people could have a state now. And it, you know, the comparison with the Zionists is interesting because they kept saying yes to some pretty terrible plans.
Yeah.
I mean that, you know, the initial plans giving them a tiny statelet, which might or might not have been able to survive.
Right.
But they said yes. The Palestinian leadership and, you know, you can't, I don't know who you blame for this, fate more than anything, because these were not people chosen in democratic elections, is responsible, I think, for much of this terrible problem we have seen recently in Israel. It's quite interesting. Leaders of the Israeli Arab community emerge who are trying to integrate their own people more and more in the system, trying to get out the vote, who have participated recently in a government. It's a completely different leadership than, very sadly, tragically, Palestinian Arabs in Gaza and the West Bank have gotten really what since the 1930s?
Yeah, and people don't realize one of the reasons Israel was able to become a state quickly, despite the fact that war was made on it the day after it declared independence, was the Jews living in Palestine, the Palestinian Jews. In fact, when people talk back then of Palestinians, they probably meant Jews. So the, you know, the major newspaper was the Palestine Post. There's the Palestine Sympathy. These were all Jewish, right? Palestinian had not been taken as a word only to mean Palestinian Arabs, including by the UN, because they had set up a sort of state with that wasn't quite a state, right? Even before they had institutions and they were fighting among themselves as they were, but it was all now the Palestinians have had time to essentially organize a state over the past 20, 30 years. And we know haven't done so, as you say, Mahmoud Abbas is 87. Nobody knows who's going to succeed him. They don't have a process for that. They had one election years ago. Not again. None of these processes and institutions and bureaucracies, the things that are necessary for statehood, have been set up. This might have been something these authors would mention as a problem that needs to be solved. But no, I guess they figure once Palestine becomes a state from the river to the sea and is free, the Jews will figure it out for them if they survive. I don't know. But again, it's conspicuous by its omission.
It is. As I look back on this, as someone who served in the George W. Bush administration, you know, there was a moment there where we were reasonably optimistic because Bush had insisted on the sidelining of Yasser Arafat. And at one point, we insisted that the Palestinians get a government in place that was competent and honest. And this was Salam Fayyad was prime minister.
And of course, I've known him.
Yeah. And it worked. And of course, the problem was so many people in that system did not want a competent, honest government because they were on the gravy train. These were people, he was not a member of the Fatah party. And these were people who were big
shots. Salam Fayyad was not a member.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah. And he had no base, essentially, right. Yeah.
He wasn't on that gravy train. And the people who were
right
said, well, get rid of this guy. We want the old days back. Well, now they have the old days back. Hundreds of millions of dollars is pouring into the West Bank still.
Yeah.
And, you know, you can see some of it in schools and hospitals and other very good common goods. And a lot of it disappears into and has for decades into people's pockets. And we know what West Bank Palestinians think about this, again, from opinion polls. 80% of them think the Palestinian Authority is corrupt. Again, there is a lot to talk about here. How would you change that? Is it possible to move again toward a Palestinian Authority that is competent and isn't corrupt? I'll give you another one, the Abraham Accords. Is it possible to somehow pull in, to motivate the Arabs who are now in relationships with Israel to help in this, in the West Bank, to use their influence over the Palestinian Authority? Why now? Well, now because we're coming to the end of the Abbas era. Change will come. Not discussed in this article. It's just, as you said, because Palestinians have no agency. Palestinians are objects. The problem is most of all the Israelis, but of course also the Americans and others. But the notion that Palestinians should act to determine their fate is another thing that's absent in this article.
And if I may, I think it's even worse than that in this article because I pick up from it implicitly or more that they are opposed to the Abraham Accords. They think that's a bad idea. I think you mentioned that in your piece. They are opposed to anything called normalization. It seems to me if you want to help the Palestinians, if you want to go towards peace, you don't think let's get a piece of paper that everybody signs. You think, let's go towards normalization. Let's get people used to working together, Palestinians and Israelis. The Palestinians learn, okay, this is how the Israelis do it. We don't have to do it that way, but it's not so bad. Yeah, you know, when you had this, for example, what was the name of that seltzer water that they were
making? Oh, God, yes, yeah.
SodaStream, thank you. Okay, so you have the SodaStream factory. Thank you, Daniel. The SodaStream factory in the West Bank, and you had Israelis and Palestinians. They were all getting health insurance for their families, even though the Palestinian families were big and extended. They were working together, men and women, Jews and Muslims, eating in the same cafeteria. What happened? The people who were against normalization, the BDS people, they managed to force SodaStream to close that factory. They could not stand the idea of normalization, a path to people getting used to saying, you know what, I've got this good friend, he happens to be Jewish, I got this good friend, he happens to be Muslim, we had dinner together with the families, it was lovely.
It is in this article. The United States should stop trying to get countries to join the Abraham Accords. And they also, as I said before, call for sanctions on Israel. So where are we going here? From the Abraham Accords, where the United States is trying to promote relations between Israel and its Arab neighbors and other Arab states, we're going back to the Arab boycott. That's what this is.
Yeah.
If you say, forget the Abraham Accords and let's start sanctioning, we're going back to the Arab boycott, which the Arab states have dropped, but our professors—
Which was immediately after the Israel's existence, right? Which is, so people know, we're talking about an Arab boycott of the very, very early years, 1950s, and the U.S. was opposed to that. Because again, it was a way to strangle Israel. Don't buy Jewish, don't buy Israeli. Kind of also, by the way, exactly what the Nazis did before the Holocaust, right? Kristallnacht, don't buy from the Jews.
And it came back after the 67 war. Arab League meeting in Khartoum, and the so-called three no's, you know.
Very important to be honest, these three no's. 1967, right, it's a defensive war. Nasser is very clear, we're going to wipe out the Israeli state. Israel manages to take the West Bank from Jordan, not from Palestinians, from Jordan, because Jordan had conquered it in 1948-49 and expelled all the Jews and desecrated the religious sites. They took Gaza from Egypt. Now the Israelis have a great idea. What about these two territories becoming a Palestinian state? Then we can have, they can have a state, we can have a state, we give up known land, peaceful coexistence. And as you say, in Khartoum, what do the Arabs say? No peace, no recognition, no negotiations. So I got that right?
That's right. There was, of course, in 73, the Arab oil boycott us, that is, of the United States. We've come a long way from there. And for a long time, there was a real bipartisan consensus in the United States that, for example, the Arab boycott was a terrible thing and that the United States was doing a wonderful thing in promoting peaceful political and economic relations among all of these countries in the Middle East. But that is not what this article says. What the article says is this has empowered Israel. This has supported, helped the apartheid system that exists. So the United States should be drastically, fundamentally changing its position with respect to Israel. No more Abraham Accords, no more normalization with Arab countries. Instead, sanctions on Israel and on Israeli leaders. It's actually a very radical article. Mm-hmm, it really is. And some of the reaction to it, it's quite interesting, has been, what are you getting so excited about? This is where the professoriate is. This is where the academy is. This is what's being thought in the universities. That may be true, actually, which is pretty terrifying. It may be true that they're not such terrible outliers when it comes to much of what is being taught and said in universities, which fortunately has not yet spread to the United States Congress. There are a few people. You mentioned Rashida Tlaib. There are a few others, but so far, so good.
And Bernie Sanders managed to make sure she would have a NACLA Day celebration on congressional.
We should note what happened there. One more detail, which is she took a room in the Capitol Visitor Center for Rashida Tlaib for her Nakba Day event. And Kevin McCarthy, the Speaker of the House, bounced her using his prerogative as Speaker. He took the room. And she therefore had no place to go until Bernie Sanders, a Jew, came along and offered her a place to hold forth. Pretty sad.
So there's a million other things we could talk about and I haven't in my notes. I'll mention one. They talk about the Golan Heights as if it's Palestinian territory. Of course, it was Syrian territory and the population there was Druze. And the Druze there have been offered Israeli citizenship and some have taken it. The only reason some don't is what if the Israelis give this back to the Syrians? We'll all be killed if we're Israel. So, but they don't seem to. Again, these are professors of Middle Eastern studies. They don't know this.
Pat Moynihan used to say, everyone's entitled to his own opinions, but you're not entitled to your own facts. And they've got some, the Golan Heights, the Gaza example, the nature of what they call apartheid and Israeli society. They're really not dealing with facts here. I would not give this paper a passing grade.
I'll ask this as the exit question, unless there are other things you want to talk about. But it's also the hardest question. So, okay, the views they're expressing here are very common on campuses, very common in the academia, common in Amnesty International at the UN. Are these anti-Semitic views? Are these views that are – has the Jewish state become what the Jewish individual was in Europe circa 1938?
I guess if I had to give a one-word answer, it would be no. That is, obviously, there are many critics of Israel who are pointing out, for one thing, there are many people who are pointing out fair criticism. And there are many critics who are unfair, but certainly not anti-Semitic. On the other hand, one of the definitions of anti-Semitism is to apply to Israel standards that are not applied to any other state or for Jews to apply to any other group in the population. They are applying here standards that are applied to no other state, for example, in the definition of apartheid. So I, you know, would not accuse the four of them of anti-Semitism. I would accuse them of academic malpractice. I would accuse them of having a chip on their shoulder. I would accuse them of treating Israel very unfairly. But I'd need to know these guys a lot better.
I'll put it this way for you. You don't have to respond. I would say it may not be anti-Semitism, but it sure rhymes with anti-Semitism.
It's a great place to stop.
Elliot, always great to talk to you and great to see you. Thanks for coming in today. Thanks for all you do.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And thanks for all of you who are with us today here on Foreign Policy.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Foreign Policy. If you enjoyed the show, please rate us, preferably with 5 stars. Ratings and reviews help give us visibility and the opportunity to reach more people who seek to understand the most critical national security and foreign policy issues. Also, make sure to subscribe so you never miss an episode. Follow FDD on social media and visit our website at fdd.org. There you can find research by FDD experts, you can subscribe to all FDD's products, you can catch up on any past episodes you may have missed. Finally, we'd love your feedback, your ideas, your questions, your criticisms. Send us an email at foreignpodyssey@fdd.org. Until next time, I'm Cliff May. And you've been listening to Foreign Policy.